Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. As in any war, we must know our enemies, especially adherents to the totalitarian Islamic ideology known as Sharia, if we are to counter them and preserve our country and constitution, which they explicitly seek to destroy. Since before 9/11, we at the Center for Security Policy have worked to raise awareness of this threat by producing a dozen books, hundreds of videos, and innumerable articles, op-ed pieces, and interviews. In December, I was asked for such an interview by Matthew Rosenberg of the New York Times. I agreed, even though I knew that the so-called Gray Lady has been reduced to a house organ for the hard left, its political machine, the Democratic Party, and such radicals' unlikely allies, Sharia supremacists, like the Muslim Brotherhood. I expected Rosenberg to perpetuate the Times patron's false narrative that I am a hater and Islamophobe, so I secured his permission to record what turned out to be several conversations. Consequently, I was prepared when he smeared me on February 2nd in a lengthy article on the Times front page under the headline, quote, "A Sinister Perception of Islam Now Steers the White House," unquote. The article was principally a hit piece against President Trump. It also castigated his national security advisor, Michael Flynn, and his chief strategist, Stephen Bannon. Then, Rosenberg threw in at the article's end five paragraphs and a picture with a caption that defamed me. Specifically, the article and caption claimed, respectively, that I viewed, quote, Islam, unquote, and, quote, Muslims, unquote, as, quote, termites that hollow out the structure of the civil society and other institutions for the purpose of creating conditions under which the jihad will succeed, unquote. Now, taking quotes out of context is a favorite trick of agenda-driven journalists, but that required Matt Rosenberg to distort about 2.5 hours of conversation in which I repeatedly explained that my focus is on countering the stealthy jihad of the Muslim Brotherhood and its ilk, and applauding Muslims who reject their toxic totalitarian ideology. Listen to a couple of illustrative clips the Times failed to acknowledge so as to misrepresent my views, and it would appear, help the Brotherhood suppress our exposés and warnings. First, here's how I introduced Rosenberg to the threat posed by the Muslim Brotherhood and its stealthy civilization jihad during our first conversation by phone on December 1st, 2016.
The United States government introduced into evidence in the course of the largest terrorism financing trial in U.S. history a document called the Explanatory Memorandum on the General Strategic Goal of the Group in North America, which it was the government's position in the course of that trial amounted to a secret plan of the Muslim Brotherhood for, in its words, destroying Western civilization from within by their hands, meaning ours, and the hands of the believers, so that God's religion was made victorious over all other religions. Now, in a helpful addition to that strategic plan, the Brotherhood attached a list of 29 organizations under the heading, Our Organizations and Organizations of Our Friends. And that 29-group list, to this day, some 25 years after it was written, still represents the core of what we're told are the mainstream Muslim groups in America, the Muslim leadership, and the degree to which the Muslim Brotherhood owns and operates all of those groups, and now probably one or two orders of magnitude more that have come into being since 1991 that were not on that list, including notably the Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE. That's the cohort that we have been told has to be reached out to, engaged, accommodated, and enabled to be part of the policymaking process with respect to anything we do vis-a-vis the Muslim community in the United States. that is, in short, a formula for, you know, people who have as their express purpose destroying us, using such opportunities to take us down. So that's a key set of facts that has yet to be rebutted by anybody. And it has been systematically ignored by the United States government since the Holy Land Foundation trial.
Here's my response to a question Rosenberg asked about Mr. Trump's national security advisor, Michael Flynn.
He's clearly been challenging some of the politically correct orthodoxy about national security in general, and specifically about, you know, radical Islamic terrorism, as I think he calls it. I don't particularly care for that term because I don't think it really captures the problem, because what, as I said to you earlier, is a multifaceted threat, is bigger than terrorism. And while I think of it as radical, most people would, it is, according to the authorities of Islam, something that is part of its DNA, namely Sharia. They're clearly Muslims who don't believe that, and I think they are our natural allies, but there are others by the probably hundreds of millions who do believe that it's God's will that they pursue the imposition of Sharia worldwide through what other means. The violent jihad is clearly the most efficient and preferred, according to Muhammad's own experience. There's the hijra, the migration. There's the zakat, or what I think is probably in our lexicon described as material support for terrorism, at least in part. And then there's, of course, what the Muslim Brotherhood calls civilization jihad, the subversion, stealthy, not so much nonviolent, as we're often told it is, but pre-violent means of advancing the same ends. So, you know, you put all that together, and it's more than just terrorism, for sure. And it is a problem that we need to think about afresh. And I think Mike has been doing a lot of that, and I commend him for that.
Note, I said, quote, "There are clearly Muslims who don't believe that, and I think they are our natural allies," unquote. In a subsequent in-person interview a week later, I discussed again the Muslim Brotherhood, its civilization jihad, and its explanatory memorandum. I told him I thought it
is the single most important book, as far as I'm concerned, on the subject, because it is a secret plan that the Muslim Brotherhood's leadership here in America wrote in 1991 as a report back to the mothership in Egypt, never meant for our eyes, but it lays out both what their mission is, which is described as destroying Western civilization from within by their hands, meaning ours, and the hands of the believers, so that God's religion is made victorious over all other religions. And then it proceeds to say, in the way of a report, as to how they're coming some 25 years after they began, with this stealthy, subversive kind of jihad, by which they essentially, like termites, hollow out, you know, the structure of civil society and other institutions, government institutions included, for the purpose of creating conditions under which the jihad will succeed, perhaps through a violent phase, or perhaps otherwise.
I'm talking about the Muslim Brotherhood's role as being like termites, as they pursue their civilization jihad. But Matt Rosenberg asserts I was describing Muslims and their faith. This is the more outrageous in light of the following question he put to me and my reply.
How big of a problem do you think this is? I mean, how many American Muslims do you think subscribe to this? I mean, anybody who tells you there's just no radicalism at all among any religious group is an idiot. They're a total moron. That means they've never met a religious person in their life, or known a lot of them. Some more than others. Right now, I think there are certainly Muslims out there who want to destroy the West. So I'm not going to argue about that point. I know them. I've met a number of them. I personally haven't seen a lot of it in the U.S. Well, I'll say that up front. So I'm predisposed to think law enforcement issue, let it be that and move on, and not make too big a thing of it. But you seem to think it's a bigger problem, that there's more out there than I'm seeing or others are seeing.
Well, yeah, I do. What I'm saying, and I emphasize it at every opportunity, is there is some number of people. I have no idea what it is. I think it's a rather larger percentage here
been in lots of the hellholes you've been living in, who don't know from Sharia, or at least if they know about it, don't want to live under it, don't want to practice it themselves, certainly aren't about imposing it on other people. And I think they're potentially not just our friends, but they may be actually decisive to this outcome.
I have asked for the New York Times to retract their fake narrative that deliberately misstated my views, but it has yet to happen. It's stunts like this that have discredited the Times and alienated many of its readers. Stay tuned for more of Secure Freedom Radio.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Claudia Rosette, one of the great investigative reporters and observers of the international scene of our time. She is these days associated with Forbes.com and PJ Media. She is the foreign policy fellow for the Independent Women's Forum. She has been extraordinarily impressive over many years in her analysis and, accountability projects with respect particularly to the United Nations. And it's always good to have a chance to talk with her about what's going on there these days and more generally around the world. Claudia, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you very much, Frank. Great to be here.
Let's talk first and foremost about sort of the state of play in the United Nations. We had Nikki Haley, the new U.S. ambassador, last week make her maiden speech, somewhat critical of Vladimir Putin in connection with what he's been up to in Ukraine, which some have observed may be a little bit odds with what has been kind of the leitmotif of Donald Trump's candidacy and now his early presidency. What are your thoughts on what's going on there, Claudia?
I think what she's saying at the UN reflects what he's hired her to do. And, you know, I don't think we've had a clear statement of real concrete policy at this point from President Trump on Russia and Vladimir Putin. I think the clearest we're getting at the moment has been something like Nikki Ambassador Haley's speech. And I think what's unclear to me is what is a potential negotiating position, what is a real sort of stand on policy. That's really not been clear. But what the Trump administration inherited from President Obama was a chaotic and disastrous policy toward Russia, which consisted of basically 6 years of appeasement, flexibility, surrender, retreat, apology, followed by a sort of ineffectual period of the final stretch of protest over the aggressive moves that Obama's policy basically invited. And then in the very final weeks after the election had gone unexpectedly to Donald Trump, suddenly Russia became President Obama's number one villain of the universe. You know, this was not consistent. It was disastrous. That's what now needs to be straightened out. I think what Ambassador Haley was saying was excellent. She's got her work cut out for her because Russia at the UN wields a veto on the Security Council and is very happy to use it. They use the UN as one of their world bully pulpits. She's going to have to stand up to that. The fact that she's already begun doing that, I hope she continues, we shall see, suggests to me that Trump is serious about standing up to Russia, whatever the various confusing announcements have been at the top.
And Claudia, as you look at this, and again, I know you're overseas, so you may have not caught this story, but President Trump, in an interview with Bill O'Reilly last night, made a comparison between Vladimir Putin's murderous regime and, it would appear, some unsavory things the United States has been known to have done over the years. This has been described as moral equivalency. Others have attributed it to his effort to kind of try to find a way to work with Vladimir Putin. What's your read on that, Claudia?
I don't think it's a good way to speak about it. I think that President Trump on some things would do well to think through more carefully exactly what he is saying, trying to say, and so on. You know, on one level, you know, sort of the way President Obama had it somewhat right, that nobody's perfect. America isn't perfect. But there are moments that that's worth repeating, and there are moments to just move right past that and talk about whatever the policy issue is of the hour. So moral equivalence between America and Russia is ridiculous. You know, that's something I hope the president does not continue to repeat and pursue. And we need to be aware there's an enormous difference. There has been since the beginning of this republic. America is an extraordinary experiment. That is the whole thing about American exceptionalism. So again, I don't know. The thing I think matters most here is watch what President Trump does, more than what he says. That's usually the rule with politicians.
Sensible rule of thumb. Claudia, I especially appreciate that, given that you've spent a fair amount of time in Moscow over the years observing some of the worst of what the Kremlin has done. It is indeed not morally equivalent by any stretch of the imagination. Let me ask you about Iran, Claudia. You have been warning for a long time about Iranian activities. We've had continuing missile tests. We've had the evidence that President Obama was good with the Iranians having ballistic missiles capable of attacking Israel, but wanted to keep them from developing them to attack Europe. And presumably the United States. But this seems to be going on apace. The National Security Advisor to the President, Michael Flynn, has put Iran on notice. What should American policy be towards Iran, and in particular towards its deal that this president inherited from the last one on Iran's nuclear program?
The deal is rotten. It was rotten from the beginning. It was sold with lies and the Ben Rhodes narrative to whoever bought it. You know, it was bulldozed past Congress, basically, or over Congress. It's not going to hold no matter what happens. We're seeing this ballistic missile testing. Ballistic missiles are for carrying nuclear weapons. Okay, that's what they're testing. And there's every reason to be concerned that they are collaborating with countries like North Korea, possibly Pakistan, or that they will. This is extremely serious. And the problem now is what happens next? What can the Trump administration do? Frank, sanctions are not going to solve this. They simply won't. They're a partial measure, but they're not going to dissuade anybody from pursuing nuclear weapons at this point. What the Trump administration needs to do is start to prepare the American public for the possibility that they may actually have to make some sort of strike against Iran, something that inflicts enough pain so that the Iranian regime really does think, is this worth doing? And for that, Frank, the best thing that the Trump administration could do is expose in depth the problems, the fraud that was put through with the Iran nuclear deal. In other words, stop sort of saying, well, maybe we'll, you know, pare it back, maybe scrap it. They should, somebody in the administration should now, with access, I hope, to the real records, put out just what the real problems with this deal are, and they are prolific. They are many. Explain them in enough detail so that anybody can understand, and explain President Obama's so-called legacy has left America with very little choice about what it may have to do next. He has, President Obama, frittered away whatever leverage there was. And now the problem is, with a rotten nuclear deal that will not stop Iran's pursuit of the bomb, what does America do next?
Yep. Critical question. Claudia, a similar problem is vexing us with respect to North Korea. Do you have any early advice for this new president on that front?
Yeah, it would be largely along the same lines. It would be, first of all, keep in mind that there's a whole bevy of so-called experts on North Korea in Washington who have been busy making bad analysis and negotiating terrible deals for years. It's time to scrap that crowd. They've had more than enough say. There's a whole roster of names that have been circulated forever, at least for yeah, more, almost a quarter century.
The usual suspects are being rounded up, it sounds like. Claudia, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Don't bring them back. That's the bottom line. Thank you so much.
Do not bring them back, and do tell us the truth about just how bad the problem is.
Amen. We look forward to having you back in the United States. Safe travels in the meantime. Thank you for the great work you do at Forbes.com and PJ Media, of course, the Independent Women's Forum. We'll talk to you again soon. Next up, we'll talk with Gordon Chang. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined by Gordon Chang, our duty expert and that of many others in the United States and elsewhere around the world when it comes to matters involving Asia. He is, of course, a columnist these days with the Daily Beast and contributes to Forbes.com and WorldAffairsJournal.com, also to Fox News Channel with great regularity, among many, many other outlets. We're always proud and privileged to have him here with us each week. The author of The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. Gordon, we're glad to have you. Welcome back.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Well, give us a rundown, Gordon, on the maiden voyage, if I can call it that, of our newly minted Secretary of Defense, James Mattis. Certainly no stranger to the region, but he's just completed, I believe, his first visit there as the Secretary of Defense. What did you think he tried to accomplish, and what did he, in fact, get done?
Mattis's trip has been called Mission Reassurance, and that's exactly what he did in both Seoul and Tokyo, where he talked about the United States standing with its two allies. First of all, in Seoul, he mentioned that the United States has pledged to go forward with the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense Missile Defense System, which is supposed to be deployed on South Korean soil this year, despite Chinese objections. And he also said that the United States would react overwhelmingly to a North Korean strike on the South. And in Tokyo, and perhaps this was the most specific and important point he made on his trip, he said that the Senkaku Islands, which Japan administers and China claims, are within the ambit of Article 5 of the U.S.-Japan Mutual Defense Treaty. In other words, the United States doesn't take a position on their sovereignty, but it does say that they are within the ambit of the treaty, which means we will defend them. So that was important because the Japanese need to hear that. This is consistent U.S. policy. Secretary of State John Kerry in April 2015 made the same pledge. The difference is that it took the Japanese months to coax that out of the Kerry, whereas this was in the beginning of the Trump administration. And it comes, by the way, ahead of Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's trip to Washington on Friday.
Then there was a development, speaking of missiles and missile defenses, Gordon Chang, that caught, I think, many of us somewhat by surprise. And that was, as reported by Bill Gertz, the emergence, the testing by the Chinese of a 10-warhead missile, the configuration of the DF-5C. This has got to be increasing the level of concern both in the region and certainly to us here in the United States about what China is up to, shouldn't it?
Of course. And the other thing that China did was it trundled out its DF-41 missile, which also is MIRVed, has perhaps a dozen warheads on it. It sent that out and had it photographed in the northern part of China, very close to the Russia border, also in the western part of the country. So it shows the deployment of a mobile missile, which was indeed very threatening. This is an indication that the Chinese want us to see what's going on. And therefore, in connection with the development you mentioned about the DF-5, this is very worrying.
And Gordon, something that we talked about with Bill last week that I'd just like to get your take on as well, and I know we've discussed it in the past, but it's really brought into focus by these two developments. And that is the long-time assessment of the U.S. government, I believe certainly the U.S. arms control community, has been that the Chinese have, for whatever reason, capped the size of their nuclear arsenal at something between 200 and, I think, 400 nuclear weapons. It wouldn't take many of these DF-41s or DF-5Cs to completely fulfill that level. And is there any reason to believe that, in fact, that's the totality of the Chinese arsenal? Or should we really be rethinking fundamentally whether they are now on their road to having very large numbers of these weapons, perhaps even more than we?
I think that within the last 2 or 3 years, there has been a reassessment in Beijing, and they decided to go for a much larger deterrent. You know, there could be a lot of arguments over how large the Chinese number of warheads were 5 years ago, and the range is startling from that 200 to 5,000. But I think clearly there has been a decision recently to increase the nuclear arsenal and ramp it up very, very quickly. So whatever it was in the past, it's going to be much larger in the next several years.
We will be obliged to watch this closely, especially as there's evidence that the Chinese intend to be rather more bellicose. Gordon, in fact, one of the things that you've written about is concern that the Chinese are actually destabilizing our allies in South Korea at the moment. Is that also about this missile defense system?
Yes. China has imposed a number of economic sanctions in effect on South Korea. So, for instance, it has prohibited the import of South Korean cosmetics, which is a very big item. It won't let South Korean K-pop groups travel China. They've stopped charter flights between the two countries, and they've limited the number of Chinese tourists going into South Korea. Also, they are threatening the Lotte Group. And Lotte is important because it is in a midst of a deal with the South Korean Defense Ministry to swap land, and that the land that the Defense Ministry would get is a golf course in the southern part of the country where they would put this THAAD missile defense battery, the first one. So China is trying to prevent Lot from agreeing with Seoul to that deployment. This is going to be something that we need to watch because we should be imposing costs on China for their imposing costs on South Korea. You know, I can sort of understand what the Chinese are doing. They think that they can bully South Korea, but we have a much larger economy. We have a lot of tools in which to affect China's decisions on South Korea. And by the way, Frank, when you step back and look at this in the larger context, China has armed North Korea. Now China is trying to prevent the United States and South Korea from defending themselves from the threat that China created. So, yeah, the Chinese are trying to do that, but what we need to do is to back up our ally South Korea, and we haven't done that up to now.
Yeah, it's time for a course correction here for sure, and I hope that Jim Mattis's time in country will be conducive to that. Gordon, lastly, you've written at Forbes.com that with respect to the effort to put Iran on notice, the U.S. government may need to sanction China's banks. Talk about the relationship between the Chinese and the Iranians at this point, and specifically in the context of the burgeoning threat from Iran.
Well, on Friday, the Treasury Department imposed sanctions on three networks that Iran has been using to procure items and technology and components for its ballistic missile program. One of those three networks includes three Chinese individuals and two Chinese companies. And so those are sanctions from the Treasury Department have effectively been levied on China. But these are minor sanctions because, first of all, these are small fry Chinese individuals and companies. And we have not been willing to do what is absolutely necessary, which is to impose sanctions on China that will hurt. And the one way we can do that is we know that these Chinese entities and individuals have been using Chinese financial institutions for illicit commerce, and not only with Iran, but also with North Korea. We have not been willing to impose sanctions on Chinese banks. Now, if we did that, if we unplugged them from the global financial system, it certainly would shock global markets. But we need to do that because we're not protecting ourselves, Frank. We have the means to stop this trade between China and Iran and China and North Korea, and we're not doing it, and that's our fault.
Well, it certainly seems, Gordon, and you've been covering this very closely in your various outlets, notably The Daily Beast and Forbes.com, WorldAffairsJournal.com, that the president, his intent on taking a different approach to China. So it would hopefully be the case that they will be looking hard at these various ways to protect our security, as you say, by imposing sanctions that really will get the Chinese attention and doing it right quick. Gordon, we have to leave it at that for the moment. As always, I appreciate your time and your expertise on all of these issues and look forward to our visit with you again next week. Next up, we'll be speaking with Richard Pollack of the Daily Caller investigative arm about, among other things, apparently a very serious security breach on Capitol Hill. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by a good friend and one of the great reporters of our time. He is Richard Pollack. These days, he heads the investigative reporting operations of the Daily Caller News Foundation, but he's cut his teeth in a number of other journalistic capacities, the Washington Examiner and Fox News among them, and is always a welcome guest here. Richard, thank you for joining
us. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, listen, you did an interesting piece that in the midst of all of this thrashing around about President Trump's efforts to protect the American people against immigrants who may wish to do us harm, immigrants, refugees, and the like, you've reminded us of some of the past positions of those who are decrying most aggressively his actions, notably such stalwarts of the Democratic Party as Joe Biden and Governor of California Jerry Brown. Talk a little bit about that retrospective you did at the Daily Caller.
Well, it's very interesting. When South Vietnam fell in 1975, there were millions of Vietnamese, South Vietnamese, who had worked with the United States government, who supported the United States government and its allies, and were trapped behind communist lines. And soon people began to flee by small boats, middle-sized boats. They faced pirates and typhoons and all sorts of threats. And the Ford administration wanted to begin an emergency airlift of many of these people. And surprisingly, given all of the sanctimony that you hear today about refugees and supporting refugees, in 1975, then-Governor Jerry Brown, in his first term, absolutely said he would not accept a single Vietnamese refugee in California. And in fact, he tried to stop the U.S. Air Force from bringing in the South Vietnamese refugees that were landing at Travis Air Force Base, which is about 30, 40 miles outside of San Francisco. So it's really quite a hollow kind of like protest that you hear today when they were taking something that was really against all humanitarian law, as well as the issue of compassion for people who believe in freedom and democracy. The Joe Biden issue was very interesting because President Ford needed to have the Senate and House pass a number of emergency legislation to get these refugees into the United States. And then Senator Joe Biden was the leading senator who slow walked the entire thing and tried to delay the enactment of legislation. So, and also in the House, we had Elizabeth Holtzman, who was a very big liberal Democrat. And in the Senate, we had George McGovern, after his failed presidential campaign, trying to not only stop the refugees from coming, but urge that we send them back to Vietnam. So there's a great deal of hypocrisy that seems to be emanating today.
Well, in the point that I think you've made is that this is one standard for people who are unquestionably aligned with us and another for people who are potentially quite hostile to us. Not all of the folks who are coming out of Iran, for example, or Libya or Syria are hostile, but there's a serious prospect that they are, given the nature of the societies from which they come, Richard Pollack. And I guess this is what makes your reporting so valuable, is you're able to sort of put the Klieg lights on well, hypocrisy on the one hand, but a very dubious double standard bespeaking poor judgment, it seems to me.
I think it is a double standard, Frank. The truth of the matter is that the South Vietnamese were fleeing communism, and liberals have always been kind of ambivalent about communism. They sort of see it having so-called progressive kinds of tendencies, etc. And you know, what's really interesting, bringing us up to date here, one of the last acts of President Obama before he left office was to sign an executive order eliminating Cubans who were coming to the United States if they touched U.S. land up until the last weeks of the Obama administration. If they touched U.S. land, they were automatically accepted. And in fact, President Obama said he wanted to send these communist refugees back to Cuba if they tried to go and leave Cuba, which made the people in Havana very, very happy. So there's like a double standard between those who are fleeing communism and then those who are our enemies. I mean, it's really quite interesting.
Hey, Richard, I know you didn't report this story. Luke Rosiak did, and I hope we'll have him on shortly to discuss it with us in more detail. But I did want to just call attention to and applaud a very important piece that you guys ran over the weekend concerning a story that I'm sure is still very much developing on Capitol Hill concerning some, well, dubious characters, I guess it's fair to say, engaged in providing information technology support to a large number of members of Congress. Could you just give us the broad outlines of what that's about?
Sure. Last week, there was a report that there were five people who were detained and were fired who were IT workers on the House of Representatives. And that was all the information that we had. My colleague, Luke Rosiak, who not only is an excellent investigative reporter, he also knows how to manipulate data and to try to uncover things. So we knew that there were four brothers. They were working for members of Congress, and they were working in the IT area. And what he did is he took a bunch of databases and tried to see if he could match a situation where there were a number of people with the same last name working in the IT division. And in fact, bingo, he found the Awan family. And there's Omar, there's Jamal. I can't remember all of their names, but these are folks who clearly are Muslim. They broke the law. There are some reports that, in fact, they may have intercepted or broken or hacked into the congressman's emails and their overall systems. And these are liberal members of Congress. A couple of them are members of the Congressional Black Caucus, so I guess they decided they could trust Muslims. It's part of diversity. But it appears that we may be on the brink of seeing a major hacking of National Security and Intelligence Committee work by these brothers.
Now, Richard, I think it's fair to say that presumably that work is communicated through classified channels and that these folks who are working for the offices of maybe as many as 40 members of the House wouldn't have access to that sort of thing. But I think it's fair to assume that there's an awful lot of information that those members might have been communicating through non-classified channels that could be potentially a national security problem.
It could be a major national security breach. A number of these congressmen and women are members of the House Intelligence Committee and also committees involving national security. How much access these IT workers have, we don't know. But if you're an IT worker, you have usually very high administrative clearances to get into all sorts of aspects of the communications and the document storage systems within their computer systems as well. So, first of all, we don't know whether they were acting alone, whether they were just trying to get Social Security numbers for identity theft, or whether they were acting on behalf of either another foreign government or state actors such as ISIS
or perhaps the Muslim Brotherhood. Yeah, needless to say, this is one we'll be following closely. Thank you for the great work you do, Richard. I also, again, look forward to talking with Luke about his investigative reporting. And we will be following closely what you turn up. Keep up the great work, my friend, and come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.